Good afternoon. Welcome back to Passionate Internet Voices Talk Radio, Inc., a League of Nations among other internet radio talk stations, Voices of the People, United We Roar. Today is December 7th, 2007. PIVTR is the internet home for anyone seeking quality information and entertainment, as well as answers to many of the multiple concerns that the average person wants to know. At PIVTR, we not only provide experts passionate about their work, we offer you viable content and solutions. PIVTR is also dedicated to helping published mid-list and beginning writers, unknown authors, small businesses, and entrepreneurs to further market themselves, their services, books, and products to the media. And now from 2 to 2:30, let me present to you Martha Trowbridge and Happiness for Women Only. Good afternoon, Martha.
Good afternoon, Lillian. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks.
Great. Well, good afternoon to all our listeners. Welcome to Happiness for Women Only. I'm Martha Trowbridge. Our guest is Dr. Michael Eigen, internationally prominent psychoanalyst, educator, and writer. A recent interview of Dr. Eigen by Dr. Regina Monti states, quote, Michael Eigen is widely acknowledged to be the finest, most profound psychoanalytic writer of our time, end quote. Dr. Eigen is Associate Clinical Professor of Psychology in the Postdoctoral Program in Psychotherapy and Psychoanalysis at New York University. He is Senior Member of the National Psychological Association of Psychoanalysis and Editor of the Psychoanalytic Review. He's the author of more than a dozen brilliant books. For the past 10 years, to me, he's been an important role model, pioneering thinker, and cherished mentor. I can certainly attest that his intellectual contributions are matched only by his generosity of spirit. Dr. Eigen, we are so delighted and honored by your presence.
Thank you so much for that wonderful introduction, and I'm a fan of yours. I'm totally taken by the deep and real work you're doing to help people, and I feel very much on your team and hope I can contribute a little bit to the wisdom you bring to the table.
Thank you so much. Well, I'd like to introduce our listeners today to two of your books, which you call twins, and they are Toxic Nourishment and Damaged Bonds. Toxic Nourishment, published in 1999, Damaged Bonds in 2001, both from Karnak Books. And as you know, Dr. Eigen, the mission of this show is to help women achieve authentic, sustained happiness. Yet, so many women continue to suffer emotionally despite valiant efforts to the contrary. So both of your books, the two books we'll discuss today, are treasure troves of insight as to why. And I'd like to start with Toxic Nourishment. You dedicate the book thus, quote, to all who live through the unlivable, to the life no poison can kill, end quote. Dr. Eigen, what is toxic nourishment?
Well, the way I develop it, it's the fact that every relationship has nourishing and toxic elements, and the balance can tip very far for some people over to the toxic extreme, in which case it brings them to the position of having to take what nourishment they can from an essentially toxic situation. It's kind of learning to somehow eke out what sustenance one can from what is actually poisoning one. And it remains, for many, a background lifelong subcurrent that can influence the whole direction of a life. So I think that it's more widespread than we realize, and it affects the culture itself, and needs to be somehow faced and dealt with.
Right, and you have in that first chapter in Toxic Nourishment, you discuss a woman you call Alice, and in the second chapter, Doris. Yeah. And I think if you wouldn't mind just giving us a little introduction to Alice, and how I could start actually in chapter one. You talk about Alice, and you say on page one, quote, Alice grew up in an atmosphere of warm self-hate. Her parents hated themselves, each other, and Alice. Yet the hate was not cold or icy. It was mixed with love. End quote. So please tell us about Alice and how the toxic nourishment she received from an early age played out in her life and what the ramifications were.
Yes. Well, a funny thing is when I wrote this chapter, I kept making a typo. I kept writing alive instead of Alice. I put a V instead of the C.
Oh my goodness.
Alice suffered from terrible sense of deadness. So why would I be portraying her as so alive? Well, she was so alive for me from the moment I saw her. I was very touched. And a problem with certain sorts of love is they can be just as or even more toxic than out and out hatred. At least with out and out hatred, bad as it is, and it is bad. You know where you stand.
Mm-hmm.
You may be able to develop some sector of clarity. I'm hated, period, and fight against that. But if the love itself is toxic, is too much, too demanding, too encouraging, too encompassing, too stuffing, too usurping, one is confused as well as injured. The injury is confusion is much deeper part of the injury, because why should I be feeling stymied and paralyzed and done in when my parents are loving people?
Hmm.
Well, of course, in Alice's case, there was a good dose of hate, which she was able to recognize as hate. So she did have her own sector of, well, you know, I'm confused and I don't know what's happening to me, but I know something kosher isn't going on.
Well, how old was she when she became aware that there was that hatred?
I think
directed?
She was very, very pre-verbally. I think she was pre-verbally aware of it, and that when she was born into language, she was already born into a language that was polluted by toxic emotional streams.
Hmm. So could you share with us...
In a sense, she had to fight for her own self-expression, fight for her own words, her own use of words, so to speak, was damaged and damaging from the outset, and she had to fight to somehow own language in spite of the hurt she was feeling.
Hmm. So what was her life like once she became a teenager and a young adult woman?
Let me get to that. But, you know, it occurs to me as I was speaking that for some people, they can't find a way of at least partially owning language, even though it's stuffed with injury, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that population we call autistic, that they lose the capacity or don't quite develop the capacity to speak, that the injury is too devastating on that level. But as a teen, she was wretched. She was wretched. Actually, she was tormented all through her life.
Yes.
And she felt pretty isolated, very isolated. But she did have a capacity for friendship. And that, I think, was one of the saving graces that she would somehow manage to link up with friends that she had that she was quite connected to, and her relationships with guys never worked out. They always somehow felt humiliating to her and debasing to her, and they fell through. But some of her relations with certain women friends did work out, at least for a time, and sometimes for a very long time. And I think they helped get her through.
I recall reading how she would make valiant efforts to separate from her family.
Yes.
Excuse me, and move off on her own. And if you probably have at the tip of your tongue the language you used, that when she started breathing good air, it was suffocating her, and she had to return to the more toxic environment in order for her to feel comfortable.
Yes. But when you grow up breathing cycle or tasting a certain atmosphere, I mean, your psychological lungs are adapted to that atmosphere. It's like taking a fish to take them out of the atmosphere, that to move, you may want to move into a better atmosphere, but you may not have the psychological lungs to handle it.
Mm-hmm.
It's like taking a fish out of water or a bird out of air. The question is not what you want to do, but how do you go about building up the resources that will support what you want to do.
Mm-hmm. So what kind of progress were you able to make throughout the course of your treatment that would help her feel less addicted to her toxic nourishment?
Yes. You may not, or your listeners may be horrified to hear this, but Alice is still with me.
That's not hard. I think it's wonderful she's been able to sustain that bond with you.
Yes, it's been a saving relationship for us. We've gone through everything thick and thin for decades. I would have to count back, but we began seeing each other near the beginning of my practice, and I've been practicing for over 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
So we're growing all together, and there's no indication at all that we'll ever separate until one of us goes, meets the end.
Mm-hmm.
And if I were to try to put my finger on the main element or a main element, because so much goes into to the work that it's hard to distinguish and separate this tendency and that tendency. But I think an overall thing is a sustained unconscious transmission from my unconscious to her unconscious, basically, little by little, with doses over time, so that it's sustainable, that, oh my God, there is goodness in life, that goodness doesn't have to be so polluted. Yes,
mm-hmm.
I'm polluted, we're polluted, everyone has their toxic elements, but there's also a good core that... well, you write about this, Martha. You write about a unsullied goodness, a kind of pure, unsullied background goodness that can't get tainted by the taint we feel.
Mm-hmm.
That we may feel tainted, so to speak, in our space-time traumatized self, but there's also a sense of a timeless, untaintable something. X in the background that doesn't quite get lost, that somehow comes through even in some of the most traumatic situations. And I think Alice had that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost as if the depth of her trauma cut so deeply that it cut a path, I wouldn't say toward God exactly, but towards some need for something that she wasn't getting in this world, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Something that wasn't in the world she grew up in, so to speak, except in maybe little taste here and there. And that little by little, through the therapy and my lasting out her fits, her rages, her self-hate, her ghastly, not suicidal, but near suicidal moments, all the things she went, her one time she got up, I forgot if I wrote about it or not, and started swinging at me because she felt that I hated her and wanted her to leave. And I sort of had to hold her wrists so that she wouldn't hurt me or hurt herself, really. And at that time, we were also, I had a little group. And there were people in the group who thankfully said, no, I don't see that he hates you. They supported, I don't see the hate in it. And she was able to recognize that the hate was coming from some uncontrollable self-substance that had a certain dominance without her. As much as she can wish it away, the self-hate permeated self-substance, and that something to simply try to solve it on the level of the self wasn't working or couldn't work, because she would, it's like the atmosphere she would breathe was hate everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and of course, since love was toxic for her, she was paranoid about love, paranoid about good feelings, so that it was quite, we were in quite a fix for many years.
Well, when you say paranoid, if you don't mind my just commenting here, I see it as a realistic fear, because that's what she knew.
Absolutely.
That love was mixed with hatred.
Absolutely.
And was very dangerous.
And so, then it came to tent situations where there was less of that.
Yes, which is really tragic.
Yes.
Well, bless you for hanging in there with her. It's been, I'm
well,
sure.
Bless her for being able to hang in there with me, too.
Oh, gosh.
We lucked out.
You sure did. You were meant to be.
Yeah, yeah.
So in the next chapter, you talk about Doris, yeah, who also met with quite a bit of toxic nourishment, but her life path was quite different from Alice. And you say on page 19, quote, all of her life she was supposed to sparkle, end quote. So as she sparkled and sparkled, the more intense it became, the more intensely it activated her suicidal despair.
Yes.
Could you talk about that for a few moments, please?
Yes, that's quite a contrast in a superficial way with Alice. Alice, who was damaged virtually through and through and knew it. She sort of knew that she was badly damaged, that she took the hits from almost the beginning of life, and that she was in a process of lifelong recovery. Doris didn't have this picture, or didn't have this knowledge, or didn't have this. She had a different self-reality and a different picture of herself and life. She was invested in maintaining a picture of intactness, of brilliant intactness, of confident, brilliant intactness for her parents, for many, 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 many reasons, especially her mother, but both parents, really. And I don't know if you've talked about D.W. Winnicott on your show. But
not yet. I do employ his work greatly, though, in my own work. I love him.
Yeah, me too. And in one passage, he talks about a woman who, from early childhood on, her job was somehow to keep her mother in life, so that she had to keep up her own sense of aliveness and life love, because if she was just let it ebbing, come and go. Normally, we feel more alive, we feel less alive. We feel sometimes on the dead side, sometimes we feel on the enlivened side. And that's sort of a natural rhythm, and it comes and goes with many factors.
Mm-hmm.
But this particular woman couldn't let herself drop, was afraid of the drop, couldn't let herself drop out of life and take a vacation from herself, for, you might say, a mini vacation from herself during the day, because there was a terror that her job was to keep her mother in life, and her mother needed her sense of aliveness to stay in life.
Yeah, my gosh.
So, in a sense, Doris was in that position. She had to somehow, she felt she had to perform, achieve, and be brilliant, and she was totally competent in what she did, to keep her parents happy, and she didn't seem to have an accessible critique of that.
Mm-hmm.
Alice did have a critique of her family life. She couldn't avoid it, but somehow Doris's critique of what was happening to her got blurred out by trying to maintain good feeling.
Mm-hmm.
So that trying to maintain, oh, I feel good, I'm doing great, this is great, it kept her critical side undeveloped, her critical side about her parents and herself and her situation more dissociated and undeveloped. So this, in her case, spiraled. And when she went to college, a very competitive college, of course, a top-notch college, somehow she felt all of a sudden the whole bottom began to drop out, the whole negative side that she couldn't allow herself to experience all these years. began to catch up with her, and she began to feel inferior to the other students. She couldn't keep up to the other students. This was all in her head because she, as she learned, well, I'm getting ahead of myself, but she eventually learned that this was all her perception. This was all, so to speak, the dissociated or unadmitted negative side had a chance to come out when she left home. Mm-hmm. When she got out of the home atmosphere and was in college, everything she had to sit on began to mushroom. She began breaking down. And she had to get, she had to leave school and go home. She went, and going home, she went into therapy and took it easy for a year, was forced to be in a position where she had to let go of the high achievement ethic for a time period in order to recover, to nurse herself, to soothe herself, to find some way of letting herself reset. And about a year, the next year she did go back to school and was totally flabbergasted to find that all the kids she thought couldn't stand her were asking about her and what happened to you, and we were so worried about you, and we tried to reach you, and we're so glad you're back, and they were very supportive. And she was able to take that in. In that case, she felt she earned it. She earned the perception that that it had been in her head, and that in the real world there was a friendly hands waiting for her. But that wasn't so. She weathered that one. That was her first big break. That mm-hmm. she did weather, and she successfully finished school and went on to a very classy job that was also highly competitive, and did superbly at her job. And then the catastrophe occurred. Apparently, she at one point had a boss that she felt she couldn't please. And it was sort of like being, again, in the situation with her parents, where no matter how hard she tried to please them, in this case, he was unlike the parents in that her pleasing mechanisms failed to please him. Mm. Her parents kept her addicted because they at least showed partial pleasure at her. They always demanded more, but they always had partial appreciation, partial pleasure, intermittent reinforcement, so to speak, mm-hmm. of her good efforts. But here she had a boss who was sort of self-absorbed, depressed himself, and critical, hypercritical, and nasty, a mean boss. She had a mean boss, and she felt nothing she could do could win him over. And she began getting more and more depressed, more and more anxious, and she spiraled down and couldn't maintain herself in her apartment. And tried to commit suicide, tried to kill herself with pills.
Oh, devastating.
Yeah, and she was brought to a hospital. They pumped her out, and she went into therapy, saw a psychiatrist, and through various ins and outs over the next 2 years, as she started to get better, she changed her job milieu and went to move from the from one coast to the other, and she landed up with me because her psychiatrist made the referral. Mm-hmm. So we linked up, and we worked together only about 4 years, as I remember. I don't think more than that. Certainly not much more than that. So it's very different from Alice. She's definitely not a lifelong case, at least not with me.
Mm-hmm.
And in 4 years' time, being away from the family, and that was very important again, being away from the family, but this time with a sustaining background presence, not in a competitive milieu with she may have competitive fantasies, but it's not essentially a competitive milieu. It's not like performing in college or performing at work.
Right.
All she has to do is bring herself in, and she could be any way she wanted or any way that the mood hit her. which was a new experience for her. She hadn't had that in her life. She was so programmed to for this activity and that activity. She had one of those childhoods where she was always, everything was scheduled with this play date, with that activity. She was expert at so many different sports, expert at so many different arts by the time she was in high school. Mm. So there wasn't much room for just hanging out.
Wow.
So I think that was, you know, that took a while for her to get used to, but it was a real medicine to find out that she could begin to just be without having to do anything to earn it.
Right. So toxic nourishment in both cases, but two very different life paths. In our remaining few moments, could we please move on just to your other book, Damaged Bonds? When we were structuring this interview and I asked how wounded women could work toward happiness, you stressed the importance of, quote, emotional digestion, end quote, and the need to heal damaged dream work. If we have a few moments left, if we could explore these processes in light of one of your most scintillating statements, and that is, primary emotional reality is orgasmic ecstasy. And
yes.
That's a quote.
Yes. I'd love to talk about that. I haven't been looking at the clock, so
it's ticking away. It's
ticking
about 2:29.
Let me say first that that when one is severely traumatized from the beginning, that when one arrives in a traumatic situation and doesn't, and the self doesn't have a chance to begin in any other situation, that even, are we still working? Or?
You're still going.
Yeah.
Yes.
That even even one's dream work is affected.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in my view, we need our dream work. Our dream work helps us process our emotions. It helps us process trauma. And yet, if even our dream work is damaged, it's like our emotional digest, part of our emotional digestive system can't do its work. It's like living in a state of chronic emotional indigestion, so to speak, or even worse. So in a sense, the therapist in some way becomes the auxiliary dreamer or the other dreamer in the room to help support or jumpstart. It's like being in an intensive care unit for the moment, being plugged into an alternate dream function to help begin to detoxify and generate the ability for the person's own dream work to begin to take its baby steps and begin to deal with the catastrophic impacts that it's had to survive. Now, I do feel, and here we have a very common ground, I think, I do feel there is an innate background ecstasy. I feel that ecstasy is fundamental to life, and that one has to work hard to kill it. The problem is, I think, one doesn't really kill it, but it infuses, it gets infused in a more deformed way, in activities that go against that hurt one. That there's one begins to get, so to speak, an unconscious ecstatic residue in activities that do one harm. So one gets, so to speak, unconsciously addicted to a destructive ecstasy, without quite being aware that it's an ecstasy at all. One may complain, "Oh, I don't get pleasure from this, or this is awful, or this is terrible." But unconsciously, there may be a background inversion where the ecstasy has somehow taken a deformed turn, and is dry, and it's so hard to break this addiction because unconsciously one is actually one is afraid of letting go of the of the ecstasy that, that is part of what supports it. So, again, I think therapy and helping to repair the dream work and begin to enable the processing of traumatic emotions better does clear a way, clear a path where one can begin to get in touch with the ecstatic ground of one's being in a much less self-injurious way.
Well, Dr. Eigen, I'm sorry we have run out of time. It's been tremendously just a wonderful interview, and thank you so much.
Thank you so much, too, Martha.
You're quite welcome. And for listeners who wish to learn more about Dr. Eigen, a wonderful interview by Dr. Regina Monti entitled Faith and Disillusionment appears on the Dharma Cafe website, www.dharmacafe, and that's D-H-A-R-M-A-C-A-F-E, all one word, dharmacafe.com. Dr. Eigen's books are available at Amazon.com, among many other places, and his last name is spelled E-I-G-E-N. Thanks to Dr. Barbara Becker-Holstein for creating Happiness for Women Only. Thanks also to Lillian Caldwell, our producer and owner of Passionate Internet Voices Radio. Till next time, I am Martha Trowbridge, wishing you, dear listener, wholesome emotional nourishment and soothing healing bonds.
Thank you very much for listening to Passionate Internet Voices Talk Radio. If you want to hear Martha Trowbridge all over again in Happiness for Women Only, please go to http://internetvoicesradio.com. On the left-hand side of the page, click on Archives. A list of names will appear, Dr. Barbara Becker-Holstein among them, and Martha's show will be listed under Dr. Holstein's two sites, the Archive site and her Silver site. And PIVTR, whether providing you with the advice of experts or giving a voice to the average person who would not otherwise be heard. PIVTR emphasizes quality and enriching programs for our listeners' enjoyment. And before you leave for the day, I have this one thing to say from Christina Baldwin, who says, with compassion, we see benevolently our own human condition and the condition of our fellow beings. We drop prejudice. We withhold judgment. Thank you very much for listening. I hope you have a great weekend. The next show is coming up, The Proper Care and Feeding of Your Soul, with author host David Lentz, with Deborah Lentz Hill and co-host David Lentz. Thank you very much for listening, and remember, keep listening. Thank you.